Hi, and welcome to the second ThreeLegsFourWheels.com podcast. It's Paul here again with...
Chris.
Lee.
Well, what a weekend it's been. Australia, where do we start? At least we can start, which is more than you can say for five cars.
At least five cars. You might be able to argue Jenson Button didn't start, but...
He might be still going.
He might actually still be going, yeah. He might finish by the time everybody gets ready to go at Malaysia. But, I mean, it was always going to happen that somebody was going to struggle. I would have been surprised if Manor had got onto the grid. It was great to see them there. Sad to see that they didn't get their car put together in time to run in any of the sessions, which meant, of course, they were exempt from qualifying, which they also wouldn't have been ready for, and the race as well. Positive news for them is that they've decided to fly to Malaysia early and try and find a lock-up space somewhere near the circuit so that they can work on the car in private. And it doesn't count as testing. It's not in-season testing. It's them just trying to put their car together in a manner. Imagine trying to do it in a manner. There we go. No pun intended. Basically putting the jigsaw together. They've got all the pieces. They just need to make sure that they can get them to all go together. So it was a shame that Manor didn't run. And then, of course, we had various dropouts throughout the rest of the weekend.
So, in order, Bottas first.
Well, yeah, was it qualifying? Was it Q2?
It was Q2 where he had the moment.
It was before that, I think, because It was because of the back twinge. He had the moment.
I didn't know which order it had gone in.
Because I think on one of the TV programmes, one of the people said it's actually probably quite worrying for him because it happened like just driving normally. He pulled his back out.
Right, okay.
So might be something that he and his physio need to look into as to why, because he's one of the bigger guys in a car, isn't he?
He's quite stocky.
Yeah.
If
you
think
yeah.
about it, when you look at people like Hulkenberg, who look like they'd snap at the you know, G-force more than two, then you've got to wonder why Valtteri Bottas had any health problems. But yeah, so he was out late on Saturday. They confirmed that he wouldn't be racing on the Sunday, and then on the Sunday, on their way to the grid, we lost Kevin Magnussen in the god awful McLaren. It looked like his engine is completely kaput.
Well, his or Fernando's engine, depending on who gets into the car.
Yeah,
next in Malaysia, time. I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, but if I were Fernando, I wouldn't be looking too kindly upon what happened with the car in Australia.
No.
And then Danny Kvyat, a mere 60 to 90 seconds later, his gearbox failing to find fifth gear, and just having to pull the car over and stop it.
Yeah.
He had no option, and which, ironically, left Jenson Button as the last driver on the grid of 15 cars, which was a strange situation.
Who would have thought that the Honda coming back with McLaren, we knew they weren't going to come out of the box and fight Mercedes for a win from the first race.
Ron Dennis thought they would.
Well, Ron Dennis thinks a lot of things. But nobody thought they would be last on the grid.
No.
Yeah, like both, yeah,
absolutely.
They stood the back end of the grid up. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, you know, what needs to be done? Is it the car? Is it the engine? Is it both? Is it the engine not talking to the car? Is it Honda have got it supremely wrong?
In the pit interview with Jenson after the race, he hinted that we know that the engine was turned down to 50%, I think, to get it through the race. And he hinted at there's one thing that if they can turn one thing on in Malaysia, that it's a significant speed boost to the car.
I tell you now, if that was at 50%, that's pretty impressive.
Because well,
100%, that's almost Mercedes pace.
Yeah.
Well, the numbers on the dyno, apparently, for the Honda, you know, when it's not strapped into the back of the car, were pretty good for your pre-season.
Mm.
But it's the reliability now. And Ron Dennis said after the race, maybe we'll have to change our philosophy of going racing, which you can read as maybe they turned the cars down because they wanted to get a race distance on the car. And I think that's the only positive for McLaren, is the fact that they got a race distance.
I mean, it was more or less said before the start they were going to run it like a test.
Yeah.
Which I think that philosophy changed as soon as they thought there might be another chance of actually scoring points.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there was that comical message, radio message to Jenson Button at some point during the race that said, I think it was after the collision with Perez, and his engineer came on and said, "Careful, Jenson, we've got a chance of making points if you finish this race, because there may be another retirement, we'll get a point." And his response was, "Roger that." Almost sarcasm, yeah. To the point, you know, he knows, I think he knew he didn't stand a chance of being in the points unless there were only 10 finishes.
Yeah, I think the next race, I don't expect them to be 5 seconds behind, you know, per lap, because a team like McLaren, surely, if there wasn't the retirements, they wouldn't have even had this half chance of scoring 1 point. So surely they'd rather whack the engine up a bit, try and get some systems running. If they break down during the race, they break down. You know, it's better to break down and not look like you're limping around.
But is it more worrying that Kevin Magnussen's engine gave up at 50%? I think that's quite a worrying thing.
Was it turned up a little higher than 50% for the race?
Yeah, it may well have been. Yeah. But we'll have to see what happens in the future with McLaren. But at the moment, step one out of 20, 5% of the season gone. It's not looking great for them.
It's not.
Sauber were another team who didn't have the best weekend, did they really, in the run-up to the race. They had problems, legal problems, is perhaps the easiest way to say it. Guido van der Garde, their reserve driver from last year, claiming that he had a written contract to race for them this year.
And had already paid his sponsorship money in for this season.
Yeah, and they took payment, which the Australian court looked at and went, actually, yes, you should be a driver for the team this weekend. And it rumbled on for a little while, didn't it? And then, was it Saturday, eventually, the case got dropped?
Saturday dropped it. I did read that they'd opened the Supreme Court specially, or the High Court, or whatever the Australian equivalent is, specially just to hear the case, and they dropped the contempt action. I don't think he did himself any favours by turning up at the first practice session on the Friday, getting into a race suit and going for a seat fitting like he was...
No, but they didn't give him a paddock pass.
He didn't have the paddock pass. He had to get somebody to get him in.
Not only did he turn up in a race suit, he had Ericsson's race suit on as well.
Probably the closest in height to him.
Probably.
Yeah, probably maybe had a mole within the team to go and get him a race suit. Because he wasn't allowed in the garage until a certain point, until the session had begun. He wasn't allowed to be in the garage. So he would have had to... somehow gotten that race suit, and I know he definitely wasn't allowed in the motorhome, obviously in case anybody was talking about him at any point, but yeah, turning up in the garage with a race suit on saying I'm ready, when can I get in the car, is a little naive at best.
Yeah,
I mean it's, the guy's a clever guy. He probably went there not expecting to race. It was probably more to make a statement than thinking he was going to jump in the car. But realistically, is it who's the lady? Is it Marisha?
Marisha Kaltenborn.
Yeah.
She's a lawyer by trade, isn't she?
Yeah.
So you'd really have to ask yourself, is how did Sauber get themselves into this situation when, like, their mouthpiece is a lawyer?
It's a hard one, obviously. It's still an ongoing issue, so we or anyone else can't really comment too much on it.
Yeah.
All we know is he dropped the contempt action so that the team could race and staff and cars and assets could leave Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, that's not putting the team in any jeopardy. And between him, his managers and representatives, and Sauber, they are trying to come to an amicable agreement on how things can move forward. And just for the sake of Formula One, I really hope they do, because we saw what happened this weekend with the lack of cars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And anything less than that could possibly lead to Bernie invoking the three-car rule.
It was a scary sight. I think the race on Sunday.
Yeah, it got close. I mean, if you think, you know, we had, what was it, 15 starters. If Van der Gaard had gone ahead and the team had been found in contempt of court, or at least the team owners found in contempt of court, and they were told to not to race, we would have had 13 cars on the grid, and that's a grim prospect for the beginning of a Formula One racing season.
I mean, it was grim the time that we only had 6 because of the tyre issues in the US.
Yeah, that was going back, what was that, 2006, something like that, in the US?
Yeah.
But I mean, it all came rosy for Sauber in the end.
Got a quick car.
Yeah, they've got a fairly quick car by the looks of things. They did quite well in qualifying. And in race trim, despite the fact that Felipe Nasser got caught up in that first corner incident, didn't sustain any damage to the car, and for a first Grand Prix to put in the performance that he put in and stay ahead of Daniel Ricciardo throughout the entire race was a hell of a result.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think he's going to be a driver to watch out for in the future because he's got something.
Yeah, he's a legit driver. He's a legit racing driver. I think if they have got a quick car that can regularly score points, I wouldn't mind betting that come the end of the season, they'll be half wishing that they could have afforded not to have Ericsson in the car, because I think he's going to be a bit of a point hemorrhage for them.
I don't know. I mean, he did very well to finish where he finished. You've got to remember he only did 16 of the 19 races last year, and up to about sort of Monza, I think it was last year, he was way down.
Well, there was a steering column issue for him, wasn't there?
But once that was sorted, the only thing he did, what, 5 races then with Caterham, where he was brilliant for Caterham, and he managed to somehow, well, we know how, he's got a bit of money behind him, secured a drive with Sauber,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he scored points as well. But he does look
in a tank full of goldfish, the tuna is king. Yeah,
yes, quite right.
I've never heard that before.
That's because I just made it up.
That'll be why.
It is quite right, though. But in the Nasser versus Ericsson battle, if you want to call it a teammate battle, I don't think Ericsson will measure up to Nasser based on what we've seen so far. But you never know. You know, Ericsson might give him a good battle at some point later on in the season, and I don't see any reason why he wouldn't. And sometimes it's better to have a driver who's, you know, perhaps not as good as your driver who you want to have.
Ericsson wouldn't have scored points if there hadn't been so many retirements.
Probably not, no. But Felipe Nasser may not have finished 5th if there hadn't been so many.
I still think he'd have been up there in the top 10. He'd have still scored something.
He's definitely scored points on merit.
Yeah.
It's on merit. He put the car ahead of the Red Bull of Daniel Ricciardo and stayed ahead of him for the whole race. And for that, in his first ever Formula One race, is outstanding.
There's a thing there as well. I realised that Red Bull, as we're going to talk about later, a bit underpowered and stuff like that. But as we saw last year, Daniel Ricciardo knows his way around an overtake as well.
Oh, of course he does. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, Felipe Nasser did an amazing job on his first Grand Prix. As did, you know, there were other debutants in Australia who did a fantastic job, namely the 2 Toro Rosso drivers.
I take back everything what I said last week.
Yeah. Likewise.
Same.
We all do.
Yeah.
Carlos Sainz, yeah, he's not as young as Max Verstappen. He is 19, and we've had 19-year-old racing drivers in Formula One before.
Drove well.
Yeah, he drove well. He knows what he's doing. Towards the end of the race, he was a little bit unlucky that he, you know, he wasn't used to looking after his tyres so much, so he lost that position to Ericsson because of the tyre wear that he had. But
it's I heard he was using his handbrake too much.
Maybe that's what it was. Yeah, youngsters do like to do that, don't they? Handbrake around corners.
It's what his dad told him.
Which might be the reason for Max Verstappen's unfortunate retirement. Did his handbrake cable snap?
The base spins were weighing the car down too much in the back end.
Yeah, that's what, his engine mounts came off when he was doing too many donuts in the car park. Max Verstappen as well, he's only 17. We said we all said he's probably too young for Formula One. Is he going to panic if something goes wrong with the car? Something went wrong with the car, and he dealt with it like a true pro. He tried to get back to the pits, and the car let him down. He didn't let himself down.
No.
I hope we see more, and I think we will see more of him up the top end of the field, as far as you can expect a Toro Rosso to get later in the season. And I think the battle between those two is going to get quite hot.
It's going to get interesting.
The only thing to, like, negative, I suppose, to say about the two Toro Rosso drivers, or just what Carlos Sainz in there in particular, was he did tag Kimi when things got a bit close.
In the first corner,
I realise it's first race.
First corner, first race of the season, that doesn't count. There's always a first corner incident in Australia.
Yeah, there is. There is always a first corner incident in Australia. It doesn't matter when in the season it is. It's just that that's a very tight first turn in Albert Park. And,
well, there was some really scrappy racing, racing all going on.
Yeah, but I mean, Sainz only tapped Kimi because Kimi had to back out of the challenge from Vettel.
Yeah,
and Vettel, in my opinion, unfairly was a little bit too far onto the curbs and not so much on the racetrack.
Using the most of the available circuits, I think.
Yeah, he was on the. If you want to get very technical, I think he was on the limit of exceeding the track limit any further, and I think he may have got a telling off for that, which he may have done over the radio anyway. We just don't know.
I think Kimi might have had given him a telling off. They said that they're friends and they're old enough to talk about their problems. I've got a funny feeling they talked about that.
So another team who didn't have such a fruitful weekend was Red Bull. Obviously, we've already touched on Danny Kvyat having the engine, sorry, not engine, gearbox failure on the way to the grid.
One of how many gearboxes? Six again this year.
I think
he gets
six gearboxes and four complete power units. They're not looking favourable. But have they gone backwards a little bit? We mentioned before Felipe Nasr in the Sauber in his first ever race, Ferrari power, comfortably staying ahead of Daniel Ricciardo in the Renault-powered Red Bull. Is that more of a Renault issue? Is it a Red Bull issue?
Christian Horner seems to think it's a Renault issue.
I think it's a Renault issue.
So, yeah, I mean, it's unlike Red Bull to get something so wrong. It can happen, though. It can happen that a team does get something massively wrong with the package of their car when they think... they've got the overconfidence almost.
It wouldn't be unknown for Adrian Newey to get things wrong
packaging.
You know, he's packaged things extreme before and it hasn't quite worked. But it doesn't seem to be a car problem. It seems to be just an out and out drivability problem with the engine and speed,
which has led the upper
echelons.
The upper tiers of the Red Bull hierarchy to come out and say, listen, if this continues, we might have to pull out of Formula One because the gap to Mercedes is too big. And they're not just talking about the gap between themselves, or they say they're not talking about the gap between themselves, they're talking about the gap from everyone to Mercedes is too big.
Yeah, they want the engines equalising.
Yeah.
Which, when Ferrari complained, when Red Bull were winning everything, Red Bull said, well, maybe they should just get better.
And Toto Wolff turned around and said to Christian Horner, maybe you should get your head down and do some work.
Which is exactly what Christian Horner pretty much said to Ferrari when they complained about the V8s and unfair advantages that Red Bull had. At the end of the day, it's a sport and rules, and it's a game of trying to find the loopholes in the rules to make the most of it. I don't think necessarily Mercedes have done a Red Bull in that sense. I think that it's just that they've had more time to develop their package from the blueprints. They've been working on not just the 2014 car, they've been working on the 2015 car. They're probably already well into developing next year's car, depending on when the rule changes come in. But what do we think about Red Bull potentially pulling out of Formula One? If you look at Red Bull thinking about, or even making suggestions that they might pull out of Formula One, you're going to lose two teams there straight away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it just gamesmanship?
Yes, basically.
Do you think so? I don't think so. I think it's I think it's totally plausible they could pull out. They sell a brand. They're not in it to sell. I mean, they are. They're in everything to sell fizzy drinks, essentially. But they're not selling to the extreme. They're not. Jesus, where are the words?
Their focus of the team isn't to push drink sales.
No, it's an image.
It's an image, yeah. Because that's what Red Bull sell. It's an image. Everyone knows what the drink is, because you usually see their logo attached to somebody driving at high speed, throwing themselves out of practically a space capsule, throwing themselves down a mountain.
It's the same, in the same way as whenever you see an Apple product, you see an Apple product in a beautifully painted white room with beautiful people using it. They're not selling products so much as an idea.
Yeah. That's it. And it doesn't fit the image of Red Bull to have a Banco do Brasil car miles down the road ahead of them that they can't catch.
No. So. And let's face it, 2 years ago, Red Bull's performance meter, they were at gnarly. Then last year, they were at dope. And I don't know what this year would be.
Whack.
It's bordering on whack, isn't it?
Well, no, you'd have to ask. Yeah, you'd have to ask Mark Webber, probably, as the independent...
independent extreme correspondent.
I was going to say independent radometer. On a scale of whack to gnarly, where do Red Bull sit at the moment, Mark? Oh dear. But yeah, I mean, it's worrying for the sport, because there are vehicle manufacturers who are waiting in the wings, perhaps. I mean, we don't know this for definite. I've heard that social media rumours towards the end of last year were saying that BMW were looking to see how Honda progress in this year, because they want to see if it's feasible to join a formula after the initial rules are set, or do they have to wait for the next set of rule changes to come
that,
in?
That memo is already in the shredder now.
Yeah, no, I'd imagine that it is. Yeah, BMW would probably be like, nope, that's not for us, until the next set of rule changes come in. The same goes for Ford. Ford were looking at how, I don't know whether they'd be thinking of coming in as an engine manufacturer or to own a team. I don't think there's ever been a Ford-owned team in Formula One.
Jaguar,
technically speaking, yeah. I guess we're a Ford-owned team.
And, well, for a little while, Stewart, because Stewart, before they became Jaguar, Paul Stewart sold the entire team to Ford.
Well, there you go.
Which formed the Jaguar team, so... Yes, there has.
So, yes, that answers my question. Yeah, there has been a Ford run team in Formula One before. Renault have owned a team in Formula One before, and they have publicly said that they would quite like to enter Formula One as team owners again. Mm-hmm. Would they buy a team, or would they start a team again, do you think?
From what I was reading about this, is that they are looking, if they do come back in, they would be looking to buy a team rather than start a fresh team.
You've got to imagine that if they do buy a team, it's going to be Lotus, because when they sold the majority of the team to Genie Capital, there must have been some buyback clause in there. Renault still have a small, almost negligible, but a stake in Lotus.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, they've got a slightly bigger one now as well, haven't they? Because as of last year, I think, Infinity bought into Lotus. Because I was actually surprised that when the talks of Lotus losing the name of Lotus, I had half an idea that this year it would be branded as Infinity Racing.
And Infinity, of course, is the team up between Renault and Nissan.
Yeah.
Not Nissan for our American listener.
Nissan.
Datsun.
Yeah, Datsun.
Datsun. So we could actually see Renault back in F1, back to their previous team.
What if, I realise there's ties there, but if Red Bull were to
come out... If Red Bull were to pull out, I can quite imagine Renault pumping the money in to buy the team, maybe even keep the structure to a certain degree.
It's got the personnel.
It's got the personnel already, and instead of being the Enstone-based team, which is now Lotus, I can see them being the Milton Keynes-based team, currently Red Bull, and... you know, Renault could well... They've done it before. They could well do it again.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see Red Bull completely pulling out of Formula One anyway, because they've been involved with the sport for a long time, since even before the team, because Sauber. They used to be the main sponsors of Sauber.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
When Sauber were going for the whole Austrian package.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if there'd be a case where Renault would buy into Red Bull.
And also, Red Bull own a Formula One circuit, let's not forget this. They fought long and hard to try and get the Red Bull ring onto the Formula One circuit, and they've managed that. So it would be a huge gamble for them to pull out of a worldwide multi-million, multi-billion pound sport.
There's plenty of things you could do with the Red Bull ring in an extreme way that doesn't involve Formula One, though.
Yeah, you could turn it upside down.
That'd be pretty. Red Bull Zero G Racing.
Yeah.
That is to the max.
If you throw it out of a spaceship.
Well, you know, they might end up starting their own racing series, which they already do have their own racing series, but they could put the money that they save in Formula One by having a racing series in space.
That'll just be like Wipeout in real life.
Freeze me now. Freeze me now and take me out when Wipeout's real. just quickly on the Red Bull side of it is, there's always the that lurking rumour that Audi have essentially already had talks with Red Bull that if they decide not to use Renault engines, Audi would supply engines.
Yeah,
and you've got to feel Toyota as well. If Audi are looking at coming into Formula One, although Toyota have had a failed shot at Formula One, there's got to be transferable things in the hybrid space.
What do you consider a failed shot? Because Toyota, they finished on the podium numerous times. Don't think they ever won a race.
No, they did. But if you look at the amount of money they put into that team, they were spending more money than Ferrari.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that, but
we were talking hundreds of millions.
Yeah, if you spend the money, you expect results.
They stopped fitting brakes to their road cars to pay for the Formula One team.
Allegedly.
That's why it's the car in front. Because when you get to a corner, suddenly a Toyota flies past you.
But on a serious point, where does this leave Formula One going forward? Because we've got a company threatening to pull out, taking two teams with it, other teams in financial difficulties. Are we going to go back, what would it be, about 8 or 9 years to where the teams were part of car manufacturers?
Yeah.
We had BMW taking over Sauber, obviously Ferrari was already in there. McLaren had a stronger tie-in with Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
Honda wanted a factory team, and
they got one.
They got one in BAR, which then pushed Jordan out of the picture.
I think that's what it's leaning towards. I think Audi are another team that, as you rightly said, are leaning towards coming back. Well, not coming back, coming into Formula One. Stefano Domenicali, the former Ferrari boss, is at Audi, and he was given a job to do with, I think, is it to do with the endurance cars?
I think so, yeah.
But he is in a perfect position to move that company forward into providing engines initially for Formula One, but they're a huge, huge company. Volkswagen, Audi, Lamborghini, all part of the same group. There isn't any reason why they couldn't launch a Formula One team under any of those three brands.
Don't forget, there's been Lamborghini engines in Formula One before, and they weren't what you would call successful.
No, they weren't, but I think that was before the partnership with Audi. I might be wrong, but I think I remember McLaren tested a Lamborghini engine before they decided to go with Mercedes.
But then you're looking at teams like LaRusse.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Scuderia Italia.
They were, let's be honest,
not very good.
No. Did Lola also use Lamborghini engines?
Lola, when they had the aborted attempt, I think they were using Cosworths.
Right. Okay.
Mm. And the less said about.
Didn't Lola have a bash at making their own engines? Or am I thinking of a different team?
You possibly think of a different team because they've always been a chassis manufacturer.
Yeah, I couldn't remember whether they
huge in the States. You know, so they may have had Brian Hart in at some point, but just about every team had.
Yeah.
I mean, I cannot understand why McLaren have not built their own Formula One engine. When you look at the performance that they can put into road cars by themselves, yeah, okay, they get engineers in sort of on joint projects from other manufacturers, but why they haven't built their own in-house engine and have instead gone with Honda. Easy for me to say now that Honda don't appear to be working after the first race of the season. I may well be eating my words by the time we get to Monaco, Canada, etc. It's unlikely, but
well, you can take Monaco out of the equation because that's not really an engine race. That is, for the most part, a driver race.
Yeah. Driver and downforce race. It's an aero package race.
Yeah.
And at the moment, who looks like they've got the best aero package? Mercedes.
Well, yeah. But the race for third in Monaco, as things stand, is going to be a lot more open.
Yes.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
We are, of course we are. We're getting ahead of ourselves with the future of Formula One, but it is worrying when you look at the... You've got a manufacturer who's right up ahead, miles ahead, literally miles ahead of anyone else, and then at the other end you've got privateer teams who can't even put their cars together to get them on the grid, despite many, many millions of pounds of investment. And long gone are the days of Lord Hesketh deciding that his Formula 3 team should have Formula 1 bits on it to make it a Formula 1 team. It's not what it was, and it never will be what it was, but what you've lost over the last few years, some of it has to be regained. And I think that the only way that's going to happen is by vehicle manufacturers coming back into the fold.
I think there's the talks they're going to have over the next year, into this year, into next year, for the changes of Formula One in 2017. I think there's going to be massive changes to the sport, almost where I think if you watch a video from 1960s Formula One and then a video of 2011 Formula One, I think it's going to look like a couple of very, very different animals. But as far as Mercedes goes, just being in the front, you've got to think that that must ignite other car manufacturers to come into Formula One.
I think so.
Because the reason they're doing it is they know if they are in Formula 1 and they are winning, they are selling more units. It was something crazy, like when Fernando Alonso won the World Championship for Renault, they sold 90% more cars
globally. Fernando Alonso's company car was a Renault Laguna.
Yeah.
But it's good enough for the fastest driver in the world.
Exactly.
Who are the manufacturers within the Mercedes space? You know, if you're looking to buy a Mercedes, then you're going to also be looking at buying an Audi or a BMW.
Yeah, you're looking at the German manufacturers.
Yeah.
And then if you want to compare that to, Ford like to think that they can compete in the car market with the Mondeo, the upper standard Mondeo is probably in with the BMW M5 and the Mercedes. So Ford have got a motorsport interest, or they have to have a motorsport interest somewhere worldwide. I would like to see them come back. I would like to see BMW come back into Formula One. I did read somewhere, and I can't remember where, it was a website somewhere that had a list of successful manufacturers. And Ferrari, I think, have been more successful than any other engine manufacturer. And up until recently, Ford were second. I think that's been overtaken by Renault now. I think Renault are now second. But, I mean, you think that Ford haven't been in Formula One for quite a number of years now. Yeah. Especially as Cosworth, even though Ford subsidised Cosworth, doesn't actually count as a Ford point or victory.
But Ford used to power the entire grid.
At one point during the 60s, pretty much, Ford powered almost everything. Yeah.
There's also another interesting thing that Felipe Massa said in an interview after the race, that he said in quite a strange way, if I remember rightly. He said, I can't really comment on it, but he can't say that he thinks Mercedes give them the same engines. So you've got one race there, and Felipe Massa is sort of saying, well, we haven't got the power that that car has.
The works engines are going to be different to the customer engines. It's the nature of the beast. It always has been.
But now that means for a team like Williams, who very much seem to be, you know, on the up again, that if they want to make, if they want to do anything else than come third now and again, or, you know, scrape the odd win, if they really want to try and win championships, they need to be speaking to manufacturers. They have to be. Because if they want anything more than driving around with a quick car, looking at scoring the odd podium or scraping wins, you know, it's or you know, jumping in where Mercedes fail, you know, they need to be looking elsewhere for engine supplies.
I mean, it's easy for Felipe Massa to say that, you know, look at the power Mercedes have got over that we've got. You know, we're supposed to have the same engine. As you pointed out, they're always going to be different works engines to customer engines.
But that's different when you're a mid-grid team. But when you've broke back up the grid again, and they're top three teams have been jumped by Ferrari. But
if you want to have a look at the top three teams in Australia, Mercedes, without a doubt, Ferrari and Williams. Without Valtteri Bottas and the only Williams being Felipe Massa, it's difficult to know what Williams' performance is, really. Vettel did a classic Vettel by outperforming Massa around the pit stop, took the advantage, and then managed to stay ahead of Massa throughout the rest of the race just by managing his car, his tyres, and all the wear and the fuel and everything. It's what Vettel's very good at doing. But in real terms, they weren't that far behind Mercedes.
No, I mean, they only finished 3 seconds. Massa finished 3 seconds behind.
Yeah, but
of Sebastian, so it's not a long time. But you've got to also think that Kimi Raikkonen, before his wheel fell off, he was going great guns.
Yeah, he was.
I think he'd have been third. I think he'd have got Vettel eventually, or he'd have been up with him.
Possibly.
Before the end of the race.
He would have been on top of Massa, around about where Felipe Massa was, at least. But at the end of the race, both Mercedes drivers jumped out of the car. They weren't tired. They hadn't driven a hard race.
No.
They were... That Mercedes wasn't 100%. That Mercedes wasn't
wick
turned full up. That Mercedes was... I'm purely guessing here. 90%, I'm going to say. And... It's the Australian race is supposed to be hard on fuel because of the amount of accelerating you've got to do. You're on the pedal.
The safety car didn't hurt that though.
No, it didn't. But it's, you know, on a race where you're thinking, well, you know, I'm going to have to watch this, going to have to watch that. Mercedes, they made it look easy.
Mm-hmm.
They did make it look easy. Everyone else had a little bit of a struggle here and there. Lewis Hamilton had enough energy on the podium to jump up and down, give it a bit of a fist pump when he came out as the winner, wave to the crowd. And then
go a little bit starstruck when Arnie turned
well,
up.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was hoping for Arnie, and then Arnie came out. And it was fantastic. But drivers shouldn't. When I say drivers shouldn't, what I'm trying to say is that drivers used to get out on the podium after trying really hard in a race. Look at Ayrton Senna in Brazil when his car was almost...
Well, we know the cars are easier to drive now.
The cars are easier to drive, yeah. Of course they're easier to drive, but yeah. I mean, even as you know, as long ago as 3-4 years ago, when Jenson Button was winning races in McLaren, does seem like a long time ago now.
Yeah.
But when you know he was sweaty, you could tell he fought a hard race and he was tired, but it was well worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he won in the Braun and parked up in the wrong place and ran down the start finish straight, he had energy to do that.
He had energy to do that. Yeah, of course he did. But
just won Monaco. Of course he had energy.
Yeah, but he, you know. The Mercedes, even Vettel looked a little bit tired on the podium. Vettel was like, wow, that was a good result for my first race in Ferrari. You know, I finished third, I managed to get a podium. It's something for Ferrari to build on. I mean, I think that building on this result means that they're probably going to win a couple of races this season. Paul said in the live blog that Vettel looked more relaxed and happy on the podium than he did at any other time during last season.
Yeah, it was the old Seb.
That's because he beat his teammate.
Probably was because he beat his old.
But I'd be interested to see and
teammate
if Kimi hadn't had that problem at the beginning, let alone the problem pit stop.
Yeah,
I don't think Seb would have been too happy because I think Kimi had his name on that third position.
Honestly, this Ferrari does look like it works for Kimi Raikkonen, which is a relief for everyone who likes Kimi Raikkonen. And if you don't, you're not human.
No,
but yeah. Lewis Hamilton with his designer sunglasses on came out on the podium, and as Paul said, he was completely starstruck when Arnold Schwarzenegger turned up.
You would be,
and
let's be honest.
Yeah, of course you would. I mean, if you didn't know he was going to be there,
it looked like it was a complete surprise.
It was a complete surprise to Lewis Hamilton, but I mean the two Germans were very German and stood there and bowed their heads. Yes, Arnold, Mr. Schwarzenegger, sir. And then Lewis was like, "Oh my God, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger!" Podium interviews are—I think they started it in Silverstone a few years ago, but they've become an integral part of the race. And we've had former drivers.
Do you like them?
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
I don't like them.
I prefer them to the going back to into the press office afterwards and having the interviews they used to.
But I prefer the pen interviews whenever.
Yeah, the pen interviews afterwards. They're good because drivers tend to let off a bit more steam then.
Yeah.
But I do like the podium interviews. I mean, Eddie Jordan's awful. We know Eddie Jordan's terrible when he does it because he tries to be everybody's friend and he's everybody's buddy and he's known everybody for hundreds of years.
Stealing a description I saw from a piece on cricket in The Guardian. He tries to be the matiest mate that's ever mated.
That's exactly it with Eddie Jordan. And his arms around everybody all the time and he loves everyone and he thinks everyone loves him. Not the case, I'm afraid. All the other media-trained journalists who do... I mean, we've seen Brundle go up before. Coulthard's gone up before. On numerous occasions as well. John Surtees in Italy last year was horrifying to watch because he, in no media training whatsoever, was just told to ask some questions and it didn't go well at all. It really didn't. But
can we not just get Benedict Cumberbatch to do all
Benedict
of them?
Cumberbatch was good. And I think, leading on from that, Australia realised that Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to be there and has been like, well, get Arnold Schwarzenegger to do the podium interviews. Now, he may or may not be a huge fan of Formula One racing. He says he is, but he's going to say that, whatever the...
Yeah.
Did you see him on the grid walk?
I did see
him
briefly.
It surprised me when he knew how much they weighed.
Yeah.
He seemed to know his
stuff. I think maybe he'd been fed a few facts beforehand, so he didn't look stupid if he was stopped.
Don't forget how long he was in politics. He will,
absolutely.
He will know the value of a good briefing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. He will, yeah. The governator, as I think he was referred to by himself on the live
and most
blog.
Of California.
Yeah, most of California remember him as the governator. But he was brilliant, and all the news clippings that you've seen afterwards, they've all been Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lewis Hamilton saying, "I'll be back."
Yeah,
they both thought it, they both said it, and Hamilton had a good laugh with Arnie up on the stage there on the podium. But how do you beat that? Who are Malaysia possibly going to get in?
Haven't got a clue.
I bet almost everything I own that they had an ex-driver of nondescript standard lined up to do the...
Alex Jung.
Yeah, Alex Wurz. Ready to do the podium interviews.
And now they're onto the William Morris agency saying, "Get me the biggest star that you can."
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, they want Justin Timberlake. Oh.
It was quite strange, wasn't it, having Arnold Schwarzenegger there? Because I mean, it was lucky for them because
he's got his bodybuilding.
Yeah, but he raises the profile. Things like that will raise the profile of the sport. If we're talking about, as we were before, about the future of the sport, it's kind of what needs to happen. Ex drivers. Yeah, if you saw on the news David Coulthard, as nice a man as he appears to be on television, interviewing Sebastian Vettel about something that happened in the race, the general public who aren't that into Formula One aren't going to care that much. Whereas if we saw Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lewis Hamilton saying, "I'll be back," that makes everyone laugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone loves that.
Yeah, it's down to getting good media.
It is.
I suppose we're taking the ex-drivers and putting them up there. If we're looking for column inches, you're preaching to the converted, aren't you?
Yeah.
No, it's where you want to drag new people into the sport.
Get the ex-drivers into doing the podium interviews. You will get the column inches in the F1 press, in the sports press. Get Arnie in there, and all of a sudden you're in the showbiz section. I mean, Lewis, as we know, does try and go a little bit showbiz himself.
A little bit.
A little bit, a lot. Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, pictures on Instagram of him with Kardashians recently. I was quite surprised to see that, knowing how much Lewis Hamilton can be the celebrity playboy when he chooses to be.
You were surprised by that?
I was surprised by Kardashians in a picture with Lewis Hamilton, yes.
Well, let's not forget he did take time out of his busy schedule to record his own album with P. Diddy.
Well, allegedly so.
Less said about sport and rap crossovers, the better, really.
Yes. No, Anfield rap.
But quickly.
Except for World in Motion.
World in Motion is the only good one, actually. Yeah, yeah. That, we'll let that one off. John Barnes redeemed himself.
Yeah.
To interrupt the hello section of our podcast.
I'd say with more heat.
If we to get back to the race, what did you think about Nico Rosberg?
Similar story to last year. He closed the gap on Lewis. Lewis was informed of this over the radio. Of course, you can only be informed of certain things now over the radio.
Mm-hmm.
He was informed that the gap was closing, chose to stretch it out to about 3-ish seconds. And every time Nico closed that gap by a couple of tenths a lap and got down to about 1.4, 1.2 seconds, anywhere close to DRS range, Lewis went, "And you know what? It's going to step on it a bit more here," and managed to stretch it. So every time Nico pushed, Lewis has pushed that a little bit harder.
Yeah.
And as you know, Nico was making up that ground again, Lewis has pushed a little bit harder. He had the ability to stretch the legs of that car, which is what makes me think that Mercedes was nowhere near 100% power at any point during that race.
No,
But that suggests that Rosberg wasn't pushing. He must have been trying to catch.
Yeah,
he just wasn't actually capable.
That's what I'm saying. The nature of the sport now is you cannot push 100% of the time. We've heard the grumbles from drivers such as Alonso and Hamilton about how they wish they could drive 100% all the time, as much as that's what they feel the sport
should be. Even Jensen has kind of commented on that.
And yeah, it has.
He's not
the
first person you'd think would have an issue with that.
No,
they
don't push that hard all the time. It's just how things are, and it's the science of being able to go faster without pushing harder. Mm. It's just the way the planet is evolving, hybrid vehicles, etc., etc. But Nico was pushing, and I think at one point where Lewis got stuck behind a Force India and lapping him, this was when they got closest. It might have got to less than a second at one point, but all Lewis did, looked in his mirrors and did whatever he did for the next two laps, and then it was back up to like 2.9 seconds.
He set the fastest lap twice, I think, didn't he, at that point?
He was on it.
The worrying thing for me, for Nico Rosberg and for the championship, is something David Coulthard brought up. In qualifying, in the interviews out with Nico afterwards, he said Lewis was untouchable today. That was the drive. That was the lap of a champion, of a world champion. Then after the race, he said Lewis did a great job today. He did a better job than I did. That was the race of a world champion. So, I can't take credit for this because I'm basically repeating David Coulthard's words. But is Rosberg setting himself apart from Hamilton, essentially, or elevating Hamilton in his own eyes?
Or is Rosberg playing mind games? Because Lewis says that he's not defending the world championship, he's not defending anything, he's just there to win it. Is Nico acting on this a little bit and saying, "Oh, that was a world championship drive, don't forget, the title's yours to lose"?
Almost, I think the reverse psychology almost doesn't work in Formula One, especially when you've got a driver who is as arrogant as Lewis Hamilton.
I was going to go for confident, but yeah, okay, yeah. We'll go with yours.
No, he can be arrogant, but at the moment he can back it up. Mm-hmm. It's when you're arrogant and you can't back it up that kind of get that gets my back up. But it's he's trying the reverse psychology thing. But Lewis Hamilton will just sit there and go, yeah, it was. Yeah, that was the drive of a world champion. Mm. Yes, it was.
I can't see.
You qualified 6/10 of a second faster than me. Only a world champion could do that.
Yes, yeah. You're right.
Yeah, you're right. You know,
I don't think how that
it's could, a dangerous that could game to play.
Anything. I don't see how that could be in any way beneficial to Rosberg, because even if he's doing it to try and niggle at Hamilton a little bit, which I don't think he is, he's got to be thinking these things to say them.
Could well be.
So,
it's going to pan out to be an interesting season on many, many levels.
It is.
And, we'll be back next week with a bit of a preview.
Yeah, build up to Malaysia.
Yes. And it's going to be another early start. Well, it's 7 o'clock.
6 or 7.
6 or 7. It's not set the alarm at, oh, heck o'clock. It's set the alarm at a little bit earlier than work time.
Yes, which we can deal with.
A lot easier to manage. Well, thank you for listening again, and we'll be back round about the same time next week. And keep checking the site, threelegs4wheels.com, and of course you can tweet us at threelegs4wheels. So until then, we'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.